As you may know, beloved listeners, I have a sizable collection of antiquities, what Barry Humphreys rather cruelly mocks as my broken rubble. Quite a bit of this broken rubble is of Roman origins, and amongst them, looming giant adult figures, there are three of children. They are from the tombs of Roman children who died in Egypt, where their parents were colonists. And although I've lived with these three kids for many, many years, I realise I know absolutely nothing about the children of the Roman population. And yet kids made up one third of it. It was a young population. So little is known about them. Why? Archaeologist Tamara Lewitt set about trying to dig up, no pun intended, what she could from the archives, not the ground. Her novelist sister wanted to write a book for young readers about Roman times and was disappointed to discover just how little information there was. So, enter stage left, Tamara. Tamara Lewitt is an honorary fellow in Melbourne Uni's School of Historical and Philosophical Studies. She's also a fellow at the London-based Society of Antiquaries, which is quite an international honour. Please tell me why children's lives haven't been better documented.
Well, Philip, it's because the history that's come down to us is mainly written by adult males, and indeed mostly elite adult males. So these are the people who wrote the history books, they wrote the literature, the poetry, the letters and so on, which were recorded and passed down through generations and preserved over the centuries. And they were very affectionate to their children, but they weren't directly involved with their lives or interested in writing about them. So we just have little scraps of things which we can dig through to try and find out these hidden lives of so many children.
Tamara, is it possible that Roman parents kept a little bit of emotional distance from their kids, given child mortality and indeed the brevity of life expectancy?
Well, Philip, yes, that is it is something which people debate about how Roman parents felt about their children. But let me just read to you from this inscription, which was written on a sarcophagus of a child who died. And it says, "To our dearest and most innocent daughter, who lived 3 years, 2 months and 27 days, most precious and most missed for all the days of our lives." And I think that really tells us that the people in the past were no different from us. They loved their children. Their children were kids just like our kids. I think this is one of the really important lessons of history and one of the tasks of the historian to help people now to see those in the past as people, humans, just like them, no matter where they were or where they lived, our kind of universal humanity. And also one of the things that I've been really interested in, Philip, and this has been particularly through the novel that you mentioned, The Boy Who Stepped Through Time by my sister, as you said, Anna Sidor, to connect modern children with children in the past, because there's been a lot of really wonderful historical work on Roman childhood over the past 10 to 20 years. Scholars have just started to really explore this area. But what we don't have much of is material for modern children to understand their age peers in the past. And I really want to connect modern children with the children of the past and create a sense of connection and empathy across time. And in the novel, The Boy Who Stepped Through Time, a young modern boy actually slips through time or steps through time and meets and makes friends with children in Roman times. And that really symbolises for me what I'd love to do, to have modern children feel that these past children, to find out about them, not just for this to be something for adults to find out about, but something for children as well.
One of the most vivid descriptions of a Roman child's life is a school textbook from those times. What does it tell us?
Oh, well, yes, this is a wonderful and really unique text, Philip, and it's a language text for young children in the Roman Empire to learn Greek. It was probably originally written for Latin speakers to learn Greek, which was the language of intellectual life. And it's written exactly like a modern language textbook. You know, if you go to school and you have your textbook to learn French or Chinese or whatever it might be, and there's usually a young character the same age as the learner, and this young character describes their life and says, oh, you know, and I met my friends and I went to the cinema and so on. And it's exactly like that. It's written in the first person.
Can I read the first sentence? Wake up in the morning and I call my slave boy.
And it continues, get up, boy, give me my things and hand me my clothes. And isn't that interesting? We've got the two sides to the coin, haven't we? We've got the elite or rich or upper class boy and his slave.
And I understand the slave boy would go to school with him all day.
Well, that's right. And I found this fascinating because a little bit later on in the book, the young boy who's telling the story hands his pen and book to his slave boy. He goes out. He says he's paidagogos, which is the kind of a slave carer who looked after all upper-class young children in the Roman Empire. They were kind of had parental figure who looked after them. He's following with him and he goes to school. And we know that they stayed with them in the classroom because then the boy says, you know, hand me my pen, and the paedagogus says when it's time to leave school. So if you imagine this Roman classroom, you've got about 15 to 20 students, probably boys and girls, and then you've got each of them with at least one slave boy and at least one paedagogus. So you've got about 30 to 40 slave attendants in the classroom.
I'm suddenly taken back to Hawthorne West State School, and here I am as a little learning Latin, and the only thing I remember from that time is strangely relevant. Discipuli picturam spectate.
Well, that is, as you say, very relevant. And when you were at school, Philip, did you learn Latin from the Great texts like Cicero or Virgil's Aeneid?
My slave boy learnt Latin for me, and I absorbed it by osmosis. Let us hope that the slave boy we're talking about also got some education, even if it was unintended. What language are we talking about, incidentally?
Well, the western half of the Roman Empire, so pretty much the European region and also the north coast of Africa, was Latin-speaking, and by a few centuries into the imperial period, pretty much everybody, including the slaves, would have been speaking Latin. And then the Greek half of the Roman Empire, the Greek-speaking half of the Roman Empire, was the eastern Mediterranean, around Greece itself and the Near East. And the Romans used, so the empire was very much bilingual. It was a very multicultural empire. And so people in the eastern half of the Roman Empire were native Greek speakers and learned Latin. And people in the western half of the Roman Empire were native Latin speakers and learned Greek, apparently from a really young age. In fact, you know, possibly as, you know, their first written language, they may have even learned Greek first.
Well, you and I decided to do this interview in Latin because it's spoken by most of the Gladys and the Poddies. Now, tell me about this children's textbook. I understand it only surfaced quite recently.
Well, that's right. So it was preserved, as were most of our ancient texts, throughout the Middle Ages, through the copying, the manuscript copying process, which was carried out mainly in monasteries by monks and nuns. And it was printed in late 19th century collections, but just received no attention. And it's only very recently that people have seen this as something worthy of study, with a kind of a very new interest in children's lives. So it wasn't seen as anything very important because it wasn't, you know, a great philosopher or a marvellous piece of, you know, literature. But in the early 1980s, attention was drawn to it by a female scholar, and then the very first edition of the complete texts, because there's actually many different texts of it, with an English translation and commentary, was published as late as 2015.
It's interesting, isn't it, that we've got monks who are in effect sort of human carbon paper. And I learned from you that...
That's a wonderful description.
Well, each monastery had a writing room with these monks laboriously writing out copies of copies.
Absolutely. And it's thanks to them that we have a great many of our ancient texts, because we do find them elsewhere, for example, preserved on papyri in Egypt, but a great deal of our ancient texts do come from this wonderful carbon copying by the monks, as you say.
You're listening to Late Night Latin. My guest is Tamara Lewitt, archaeologist of Roman times, honorary fellow at the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at that fine institution, the University of Melbourne, where I understand monks are still employed to copy ancient documents. Now, before you tell us what else can be discerned about kids' lives, could you take us to the Gaul region of France?
Well, that's where we chose to set the novel, The Boy Who Stepped Through Time, because I'd been there, I'd seen Roman ruins there, and the author, Anna Siddle, had also been there. So it gave her a chance to really know the atmosphere and the, you know, what the place looked like. And also I'd done previous research into this region because my own area of research, apart from children, is wine and oil making technology. So, for example, I'd found a site where the technology was changing and the workers had made a new stone part. They'd actually made a mistake in the stone, and we can see that mistake because, of course, stone lasts through time, which I found just fascinating to have this, you know, imagine this moment when the workers went, oops, we've put the hole in the wrong place. And Anna actually used this as a scene in the novel, and it became a part of an important part of the plot that this mistake was made. And that stone is actually now in the winemaking, it's Chateau, the winery on that real site, which we used as the site of the country villa in the novel. So we have the young Australian boy at the start of the novel sees this stone at the winery. They've been making wine there for 2,000 years.
And did children drink wine, Tamara?
They did, because it really wasn't safe to drink plain water. Well, the lead in the pipes, although I'm not sure that the wine would have helped much with that, but certainly contamination with all different sorts of pathogens, with bacteria, with parasites, as, of course, we've been learning over the last couple of years, alcohol kills pathogens, and wine also contains other antibacterial contents like tannic acid. So everybody in the Roman Empire drank wine. It was this kind of standard drink. Some of them were very, very poor quality, virtually vinegar. But they drank wine watered down. So both adults and children drank about three parts water to one part wine.
So if the children were sort of mildly plastered, I suppose their games were interesting. What games did they play?
Well, they might have dropped their balls, mightn't they? Because ball playing was one of the popular games for children. So they had leather balls, which they played with, throwing them, some very similar games to things that are played in the schoolyard today, kind of throw them to your companion and whoever drops the ball first is, you know, the loser. They played with knuckle bones, just like jumping jacks that you buy in Kmart or Target today, exactly the same game, throw them in the air, try and catch them on the back of your hand, except that they were real sheep's knuckle bones. They weren't plastic ones.
And I believe there was the odd yo-yo.
Well, this absolutely fascinated me, and we don't have a huge amount of evidence about it, but there have been found wooden yo-yos, and there is a picture from it's actually a Greek image on a pot from a little bit earlier than the Roman period of a boy playing with a yo-yo, which is exactly what I did in my childhood.
Kids' health, of course, wasn't great. It wasn't simply the toxicity in the water, which may or may not have survived wine drinking. But you know a little a bit about their health, don't you?
Well, we do, and we find this out from children's bones. So one of the really important areas of recent archaeological study is osteoarchaeology, where we investigate the bones of the deceased, and we can find out all sorts of interesting things about particularly diet and health. And during the later Roman Empire, from about the 2nd and 3rd century onwards, the Romans started to bury their dead rather than cremating them. So we have got some children's bones to look at. And a study was actually published this year in 2021 by scholars in Britain and the Netherlands of over 100 child burials to look at disease. And they found around 30 to 60, depending on the site, around 30 to 60% with scurvy, and around a quarter to nearly a third with rickets. And also we very often find a kind of porous condition of the skull, which results from all sorts of different disease or nutrition problems, poor nutrition or parasites and so on.
Going back to my obsession with lead, there's also high rates of lead in tooth enamel.
There are high rates of lead in tooth enamel, particularly in children who died young. So one of the things that we do have to think about when we look at these kinds of things is there's a kind of a bias. In other words, we're looking at the ones that died young. So we shouldn't extrapolate from that necessarily to the whole population, because some people who were healthier then might have lived longer, so they don't turn up in children's graves. But, yeah, the Romans were very lead happy. They used lead for their water pipes. They cooked in lead containers, which is a terrible thing to do. And women also used a kind of white lead product for makeup, which is also a really horrible thing to do, although probably not the kids.
Crazy people, the Romans. Look, Tamara, thank you for that. Tamara Lewitt, archaeologist and honorary fellow at the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at Melbourne Uni. The book that prompted Tamara's project to do this work, a novel for young readers, is called, yes, The Boy Who Stepped Through Time. And it's been a bestseller at Readings Bookstores. And its author, Anna Sidor, that's spelled C-I-D-D-O-R, is Tamara's sister. And the book has been nominated for several awards, published by Allen and Unwin.